Welcome to the Highly Objective Podcast, where we talk to cannabis industry executives and investors and go into the weeds on recent news.
Hey, Sandy, thanks for joining us here on Highly Objective. For those who might not be familiar with your background and company, can you give us a quick introduction?
Sure. So we actually implemented a cannabis banking program under Partner Colorado Credit Union back in 2015, right after Colorado made recreational or adult use legal in the state. And we had so much money running around the state that somebody had to get the job done. And I worked very closely with the regulators to do it under Partner Colorado. After 7 or 8 years, we got too big for the balance sheet of Partner Colorado and thought the only way we were going to be able to compete was to launch this into its own business, hence how the birth of Safe Harbor Financial came to be. And we are a separate entity at this point in time from Partner Colorado and actually working on a national expansion. And of course, we went public in September of 22.
And I think a big thing to note, in the headlines recently, as of called 2 months ago, April 17th, was that you resolved the $68.6 million debt obligations with Partner Colorado Credit Union. Can you just give us a bit more information about, why is that debt owed? How was it settled? What does that mean for the future of Safe Harbor?
Well, it gives us a future. That's the first thing I'll point out. But that was a relief to get that resolution with Partner Colorado Credit Union. What really happened when we went through the de-SPAC was the SPAC market really dried up in the summer of 2022, and we ended up losing commitments up to $70 million down to like $23 million. And so the difference of that debt fell on the back of Safe Harbor Financial. And that debt was because Partner Colorado was in order to get paid for the program, they were promised in the de-SPAC deal, cash sum of a very large amount. And so as soon as we went through the deal, you have to understand that half my employees come out of Partner Colorado Credit Union, and I was the CEO of Partner Colorado Credit Union for 20 years, and there for much longer, since 1995. So the relationships are still in place. And I would say that the relationships probably got us through knowing that we had to work together to resolve the debt issue. And I think there's a lot of trust in terms of Partner and trusting the management team of Safe Harbor Financial, because we were birthed under Partner Colorado Credit Union. They know how we operate. There's trust, there's relationships. And so round about March, Partner restructured, $67 million down to $14.5 million at 4.25% over 5 years. And the most important thing to remember is that serviceable debt for us. We can now afford to pay Partner Colorado that cash debt of $14.5 million. The rest of it actually went into 22, they have a total of 22 million shares, but they got 11.4 million shares in terms of the rest of the debt that we owed them. So obviously they have a very vested interest at this point in time in seeing us succeed as we go forward and increase their stock value by increasing the company's growth. So I think that it was a win-win situation. And I think we're pretty pleased with it. And now we're going to work on that stock price to make Partner Colorado pretty pleased they cut that deal.
Yeah, so just help me understand a bit more on that. So, I'm going to have a press release in October 2022, where there's the terms of the business combination was that Safe Harbor agreed to pay $56.9 million of cash proceeds to PCCU, of which $21.9 million would be payable in December of last year. The remaining $35 million would be payable in 6 quarterly installments of $6.4 million. But what exactly was that sort of, $56.9 million proceeds that needs to be paid? Was it for startup capital? Was it like things that, they lent to you so you could lend to your client and now you have to like make them whole? Like, where did that kind of $56.9 million that you need to pay out of the business combination come from?
It was a cash purchase of the Safe Harbor program, the IP, the relationships, the business itself. And what I learned going through the process is that's not attractive to investors to do a cash payout to the parent company. And I think that that didn't help our situation. And in terms of the cash payout, I think they wanted to see more vested interest of the parent company in the remaining entity or the new entity of Safe Harbor. So I think that probably didn't help matters much, but they have now taken more equity and less cash and showing the other investors they have confidence in the business.
Yeah, it sounds like that was a secondary transaction versus a primary transaction where they would have rolled their stake. Seems like they're doing that now, but probably should have just done it back in October, November of last year.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the deal probably could have been structured more like that going into the transaction, but you know, everything isn't always as you want it to be. And I think that's when we sat together with Partner Colorado Credit Union, nothing turned out quite the way we all expected. I actually expected to have more cash on the balance sheet. They expected to have cash in the bank, and none of us got what we were expecting or what we wanted. So how do we move forward with the situation that we have here and make a viable business that's always been cash flow positive into a growth business? So that, unfortunately, I have to say, took a lot of our time at the management level to get through. But now that it's over, we've got, you know, laser focus on the business here, laser focus on expense control. Not only did we have to deal with that debt, but we inherited a lot of the de-SPAC expenses to the tune of like $6 million. And we had $8 million on the balance sheet at that point in time. And so we had to go through the entire negotiation process of those de-SPAC and SPAC expenses that landed on Safe Harbor Financial. And I will be grateful to our vendors for negotiating with us and staying with us through the process. I will say that sometimes we got as low as 35 cents on, we paid as low as 35 cents on the dollar in terms of those negotiations. So grateful to the vendors.
And then I don't know if you pay attention to this, but if I just look at the stock price chart, there was kind of a big dip on December 8th. And you know, it's kind of been trading range bound, call it from February till now, but kind of walk us back to that, like December 8th, was there anything happening around that date for that big dip? Was it like a lockup or what kind of happened around there?
I think, and obviously, you know, you don't have a lot of control over the stock price, but the pipe investors had a deal in the pipe where they actually got made whole shares if the price went down to a certain amount. I think if you were to go back and evaluate some of the transactions that were happening there, it certainly looked like there was a play to sell a short to push the price down. And that price down resulted in, you know, 8 common shares of stock for 1 preferred. And that's a very attractive deal. So I think a lot of that could have happened out there. We're presently kind of looking into that a little further now that we have time on our hands. But once it got down there and once all the pipe investors got their made whole shares throughout first quarter, there was no reason to push that stock price down any further. So now I think what you're seeing is, you know, and I think you really see a dip just prior to May. Then we came out with our earnings call in May and we had a really good first quarter, looking forward to our second quarter as well. I think now you're going to start to see that stock price reflect the value of the business, not necessarily the transactions of investors so much. And we had a lot of pressure there. And of course we have a low float out there. And one of the things we definitely want to do is move some of those shares out from the pipe investors and into the market.
Yeah, and I know you've been kind of busy going around to institutional investors to get them familiar with the story, to have that happen. You know, as a publicly traded company that works around the cannabis space, what are some of the more effective ways to do that? Like, I always think additional analyst coverage may be helpful. You know, what are other ways to kind of do that?
Yeah, the problem is we're such a micro cap, right? That, you know, not everybody can take an interest in Safe Harbor Financial sufficiently to manage their fund. That's the first problem we have, micro cap. The tight float is there. That's, you know, it's a good problem, bad problem kind of deal. But at this point in time, you know, what we did do is I went into the retail market in early March. I met with a lot of RIAs, across Canada and in New York, and started forming relationships. And this was prior to the debt resolution, but I knew that, you know, I knew our contract was up and we had to come to some resolution. So I just said, let's put eyes on the stock. And I got some good consultation on that. Get the eyes on the stock, make sure people are looking. People can't buy what they don't know exists. And our story is a little unique. And then the minute you hear cannabis, you turn a lot of investors off for a good reason. There's been some, you know, ups and downs in that market. But at this point in time, when we really go out and educate on what our model is and fintech platform, and that we're not touching the plant, but we are servicing that industry, it makes a huge difference. So the first part of that is really getting the education out there. And I did a second trip of 12 days on the road. And let me tell you, I don't know that I will do 12 days on the road again. It was grueling to go through the process, but met a lot of great investors and told the story and got the education out there. Now, on top of that, I will build. I've got good lists between present investors, PIPE investors, and also the noble, you know, non-objecting beneficial owner list, so that I have all these lists. And now, on top of what we've done, performance is everything. Execution is everything. So this management team is right on top of that. We know we're only a good value so long as we're executing on business plan and providing growth in terms of our business plan. So that's top foremost on our mind to make sure we do it. But I'm doing direct investor contact, whether it's going to be through special personal emails that I'm sending out, or I'm setting up, you know, state by state visits to some of our top investors to talk to them, to make sure that they understand who management is, because I think management is one of the most important things we bring to the table. And our management team has over 50 years of combined experience in cannabis. So, you know, they don't have to learn cannabis, which is the most difficult thing to learn in terms of when you're going to provide financial services or lending opportunities to them. You know, the banking is what they have to learn. And that's not quite as difficult as learning cannabis, because if you're going to underwrite accounts and underwrite loans, you better know the industry.
Yeah. So I want to talk a bit more about those investors that you're targeting. Are they, you know, what's the mix that are cannabis investors versus financial institutions investors? What's the mix look like?
Do you know, I think that I have, you know, it's been quite a learning curve. You have to know your audience and to whom you want to sell. And I will tell you, the best meetings are those people who understand banking. We're starting to see them, that type of fund, get interested in us. Those that already invest in banks, those that already invest in financial service, fintech models that understand that fintechs have to work with banks because fintechs need, you know, balance sheet capacity and they need access to money transmission. And so you don't have to teach that. To us, it's all very normal because it's our business model. We do it every day, but it's a difficult concept to sometimes get out there and teach other investors who aren't aware of banking and how banking works at a very intimate level.
So what gets some of these investors excited about the opportunity? So, you know, obviously huge industry that's growing, that's underbanked, tons of demand. Like, what kind of gets an investor excited and then actually buying shares of Safe Harbor?
I think it's one of the most attractive things, besides the fact that we have this leadership position and we have such expertise in-house, to include the fact that I have been thought leader for 8 years at this point in time, and that I am trying to move this company forward, understanding cannabis, but many of our management team has the same experience. So I think that's the first thing they like. But I think the other thing they like is that we're starting, but we've been cash flow positive. We've been doing this for 8 years. We're in our ninth year. We're not doing anything different except starting to scale the business and add additional services. And lending is a huge opportunity as a new service for us to lend at a national level. So I think they see that the time is right. The market is right. When we started, there were only 11 states that had medicinal programs and 2 states that had adult use. Now there's 37 states that we haven't tapped into. We didn't do any marketing for the last 8.5 years. We just got everything done by word of mouth. So I think they see that we've been cash flow positive, a proven business model, a completed fintech platform, we're ready and ripe to grow the business with the right activities in marketing and sales and education and understanding the industry needs.
And going back to being a fintech platform, I think that's a big differentiation for your, you know, the company. Would you say you were a fintech company before the acquisition of Baca in November, or did that then make you into a fintech company?
So I would say that interestingly enough, we acted like a fintech company while we were under Partner Colorado Credit Union. Everything we did, other than having the platform on top of the bank, we were acting like a fintech platform, very separate entity inside of Partner Colorado, very specialized. The platform that we got with the Abaca transaction is exactly that interface between our compliance software, our service to the customer, and the bank issuing the instructions to the bank. It allows us to control the relationship. So yes, that completed our fintech model. The thing that we told investors right from the very beginning is we are either going to have to acquire this fintech platform or we're going to have to build it. So fastest way to market was the way we went. And it was also a proven model. They had been in business since 2017 and they had this model working on a couple of different financial institutions. So to us, it was a no-brainer in terms of, you know, building up our market presence faster by getting to market with this model and integrating the software. We also picked up, though, a technology team, a product development team, a sales team, and some lending expertise, even from the Abaca side of the house. So we picked up a lot of talent in that acquisition and over 300 performing accounts in cannabis already.
So what do you think now, you know, given that we're in June and sort of the environment around the cannabis space about that consideration, right? So it was 30 million cash in stock, 2.1 million shares at closing, another 12.6 million worth of shares at the 1 year anniversary, which I wouldn't bring that up. And that's based on the VWAP because of where your stock is at. So that may be more dilutive than you thought. Plus it was cash of 3 million at close and an additional 3 million at the first anniversary and another 3 million at the second anniversary. So call it 9 million in cash at the time, 2.1 million shares. But then you have this looming payment coming up of 12.6 million worth of shares at the 1 year anniversary in November. So what are your thoughts now on sort of the acquisition and the consideration?
Gee, you go right in there for the hardball, don't you?
I mean, it caught my attention. It caught my attention in the transaction details. And as you know, my day job is an investment banker. So I that caught my eye.
Oh, yes. It's funny. I've had two conversations on that this week. What I can say, and again, being a public company, you know, I have to be very careful on what I disclose, but what I can say is Partner Colorado took a pretty big haircut, right? They restructured so that Safe Harbor Financial had a future. And I think you have to take a look at that. And every other vendor took a haircut that gave us a future. So I have to say that everything is on the table based upon that restructured deal that we did with Partner, and that everything has to be considered. And I would say that we're well aware of that situation.
So I guess another way to ask you the question is, would you still do the deal today, knowing the terms at those considerations?
That's a good question. The deal would probably have definitely been restructured differently. Right? Very differently. We have to face this issue and it has several other consequences if we don't take a look at that deal. But here's the good news. Abaca has been in the market with Safe Harbor and we've been friendly competitors for 5 years on their side and 8 years on our side. So, you know, they too have a vested interest because they did get stock. They have a vested interest in seeing this through in the long term. And that, along with friendly discussions and good relationships, is probably going to be the thing that wins the day when we get to that discussion.
Yeah, and winning the day, I feel like if I look at your investor presentation, it's this commercial lending opportunity, right? Where you guys talk about the current lending environment being a typical 2 to 3 year rate, 18 to 36%, but Safe Harbor Financial, 8 to 14%. How are you able to do that? You know, tell me a bit more about the underwriting that the company is doing.
Okay, so let me first give full disclosure here. That investor presentation, 8 to 13%, was done prior to the last rate hike. Good investors want to know that one, I'm sure. So we'll be updating that presentation probably after the end of second quarter here as I go out.
Crazy enough, that was only from April. I mean, but yeah, I appreciate the disclosure.
Yeah. So I would say, and of course, you know, rate hike wasn't that significant, but we can make loans off of our deposits, which makes our cost of funds much lower than, say, a REIT that must go to the capital market or equity funds or whatever to fund their loans and have a big cost of funds. Our financial institutions aren't expecting, you know, a return of 8%, and then we have to loan on top of that. We can loan on a cost of funds, and you know, the lower interest rates were really great when we started this whole lending process with Partner Colorado Credit Union and now with other financial institutions. And as that goes up, obviously, we have to stay in line with that and maintain the margins. So our margins are still very solid, but that really comes to the fact that we have $250 million in financial institutions. We loan up to 60% of those funds to the market. So obviously that's a great deal for the clients, but on the low end of that, if you're getting 9% or you're getting 8.5%, or lucky those who got 8%, if you're getting that low, it's pure real estate. It's purely, you know, 50, 55% loan to value. We are not taking a lot of risk there. Those are good loans to have, and we have to underwrite like a financial institution because we're utilizing the balance sheet of a financial institution. Therefore, it's true commercial lending, and we can give true commercial rates. There's always going to be a premium for cannabis, just because there's more risk. There's a whole lot more paperwork we have to do. We're, you know, when we're working on a loan that has, you know, 13 cannabis shops that are, you know, tied to something, you got legal work on all 13 cannabis shops, right? You've got to do the BSA on all 13 shops. It's not just easy, cut and dry. So on the higher end now, and you had, I think you'd asked this earlier, if we did anything other than real estate, you know, we've got a couple loans on there where maybe we have construction tied to it, right? There's a little risk there. So obviously, if you go, you know, different factors, if we're going to factor in equipment, if we're going to factor in things like debt coverage or debt service coverage, how well, you know, they can actually pay this loan, it's risk-based. So every time there's a different deviation from real estate, it's an added risk premium to us. And that's how you get up to the 14%.
And, you know, the other thing I want to note is what's the difference between how much you lend in your deposit base versus like a traditional bank? So obviously some of the banks that lend to non-cannabis industries that ran into trouble, I think you guys actually are much more conservative, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, as a CEO for 20 years, I can tell you I've been over 100% loaned out. All my savings accounts, all my core deposits, 110% loaned out, which means I had to go to Federal Home Loan Bank or I had to go to somewhere and borrow funds to cover my lending. You know, that's not ideal, and especially in a market like this. But it really depends on the risk you're taking. And we were more of a consumer bank, and most of that was car loans, not a lot of business loans. Okay. So, you know, you get into the regional banks, you get into the smaller community banks, you're going to take less risk than you are as a large bank where we've seen some issues in the recent year. Okay. I think that and it's 60% of cannabis funds. So if you take Partner Colorado Credit Union and they have $500 or $600 million, it's only 60% of the cannabis sector, and the cannabis sector is limited to a certain dollar amount of their total portfolio. So it's even lower in terms of risk that way.
But let me understand this. If that deposit base is from cannabis company, you are lending 60% of it. Aren't these cannabis companies needing to tap into that deposit base more often than, you know, some of the other industries that you've worked in the past because of like the burn and because of the tax obligations. So is 60% actually still kind of high, or do you think that's still appropriate?
Well, okay. So I have been watching portfolio performance since 2015, January. I'm a real numbers girl. I like my numbers and I like my analysis and I like to see how things perform. But I also had to explain it to the regulators how this performs, because at first we had to keep 100% of the deposits totally liquid because the regulators didn't know how the portfolio performed. At 6 months, I'm like, okay, this is what's staying core. It's true that what comes into the financial institution, 94, 97% goes out in the same month. So you have your cash flow funds coming into the financial institution and moving out, but then you also have your core deposits that stay pretty steady and grow slowly year over year over year. You know, first year it was 13 million, then it went to 28 million. And now, you know, at Partner Colorado, it's up over 170 million. So it just, but it stays, that's what we call our core deposits. So you watch them perform over 8 years, you know, those are sticking around. The cash flow now, we're taking in over $300 million in cash a month, cash and ACH, other transactions like that, deposits from our companies. And the majority of that goes out. So they're living on that cash flow while they have, whether it's investor funds or whether it's, just money they've earned and they're setting aside, growth funds, whatever. That seems to be what's core year over year over year. Those are the funds we loaned out, not the cash flow.
Got it. Thanks for that distinction. Another sort of slide I want to touch upon is this growth and expansion slide where you have the states, the number of dollars of deposits per state. So obviously, you guys are in Colorado, so about $2.5 billion in that state. The next, I assume, is because of Ebica, $487 million, Arkansas. Then you kind of get into like Missouri's like $134 million, California's $385 million, Illinois's $54 million, but like a Florida, $13 million. So you obviously need to increase some of these things to triple digit millions and, you know, maybe hopefully get to a billion plus in some of these states. How do you go about doing that?
Well, even the fact that we are in over 40 states, right? That was because our clients were going there, just word of mouth. We didn't go out and market. We didn't want to go out and get all of Ohio, or we didn't want to go out and get all of New York. That was never our goal under Partner Colorado Credit Union. However, leaving Partner Colorado into the separate entity at this point in time meant that we needed to expand nationally. So we hired a high-level business development officer, well-known in the industry, Tyler, and he knows all of the multi-state operator. He's been in the industry for as long as I have. He works with regulators. He works with state officials. He knows the industry as much as I do, and I can trust him to even speak in my stead if I need to, because he's that well-versed. So he started doing the national expansion and discussing opportunities with even multi-state operators and bringing them in. But then we have now a sales team where we're going to conferences. This stuff is stuff we did not do before, but now we are. So we have separated sales. I'm not quite sure how this model is working. We're only, remember, 6 months into this, 8 months into public transaction here. So we're still sorting a few things out and I'm still doing the analysis on a lot of the numbers, but now we're doing marketing. We didn't have a marketing budget for 8 years. Now we have a marketing budget, we have salespeople, we have business development, and we have that front runner, reliable brand. And I think that's one of the best things we bring to the table for the industry. We've never backed down. They've had a need, we found a way to meet it. We will continue to do that in these new states. So our opportunity, we think, is great, because you cannot set a banking program up to meet bank secrecy obligations overnight. It takes 6 to 8 months to get comfortable to even start taking accounts in the industry once you think you have all the policies in place in the financial institution.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy that I just assume you'd have gone to a lot of these conferences and events in the industry over the past 5-8 years. So kind of shocking to me that's a new development, but good to know that there's the budget there now.
Well, I did. So if you think about when we went into it, there were very, very few financial institutions in. And when you're the only one in a risk pool doing financial services for cannabis, and you become the sole attention of regulators and law enforcement. So it benefited me to go out and speak to financial institutions, teaching them how to do cannabis banking. And then it was also the industry was just wanting so much information on how they get a bank account. Why can't they get a bank account? So I would take the opportunity to speak at conferences and teach and educate, because education was really key in bringing banking and the industry together.
And you know, I want to touch upon this partnership that you announced last month with Five Star Bank to kind of, I guess, lend off of their deposit base, right? Is that the correct way to read into that partnership?
Well, this is a new relationship. We actually, you know, started beta testing, and that came to the table, by the way, through the Abaca acquisition. That was their relationship. So we have now taken that relationship and we're managing it to a similar process. So it's not the exact same contracts that we have in place with Parker Colorado Credit Union at this point in time. And we are working towards standardizing our bank contracts between like a Five Star and Partner Colorado, so that we're doing the same thing. So we're sharing what's working with Partner with Five Star, starting out with depository services, although it is our goal and this relationship is going to bring some additional services to our clients that we think they're really going to like. We know the industry is looking for normalization in banking. We know they're looking for interest-bearing accounts. We know they're looking for lines of credit. So these are the things that when we're negotiating with new banks or new relationships, we're looking for new services and new opportunities like that to solidify. But yes, I think we've got interest in the larger financial institutions now, and this is my opinion, that they don't want to be left out of the cannabis market. They see the opportunity to loan to this industry, and they see the long-term opportunity to have a share, market share in cannabis without having to add BSA staff and all of the specialized staff, because you can't get that specialized staff out there. So Safe Harbor becomes a really nice conduit between bank and cannabis industry. And we can scale this because we have the fintech platform at this point in time that allows, and our history provides comfort to the bank or the financial institution on this side. And our reliability provides, you know, service to the cannabis industry. So it's a nice match. And I think that has won the day in terms of getting the right banks to the table to talk to us.
So is the goal to get many more of these in the next, say, 6 to 12 months to come on board as partners, get their feet wet, and then potentially loan off of, you know, a greater share of their deposits?
Well, when you consider $1 billion opportunity, which is, you know, what was negotiated with this recent relationship, we won't need a whole lot of those, right? No, my objective would be to find a few good large financial institutions with whom we can do long-term business. And there are other ways to manage those funds. So let's say that we grow to $1 billion and we hit the limitation there. The fact of the matter is the bank might be up and several more million dollars and be able to give us a little more space there. That happens over time, right? But then you can also use other means to move that money outside the bank so that you're not stressing your balance sheet. We did that a lot at Partner Colorado Credit Union, sweeping funds into other financial institutions. So I don't see that we're going to want to have 5 or 10 of these financial institutions. I would prefer to have 2 really solid national banks and one that's going to provide international services at some point in time. So I could foresee a third one. I don't think that, you know, long-term, the smaller banks are going to want to keep this risk, nor are they going to want to grow. They may want to be able to, like the Arkansas Bank may want to keep a small portfolio of Arkansas. Partner Colorado may just, you know, they've got so many national clients at this point in time, they may just want Colorado clients. So we know that there's going to be some shuffling of balances and shuffling of accounts at some point in time, but it will be probably attractive to the cannabis client because of the services they're going to get at a bigger bank versus a smaller credit union.
Got it. And then help me understand, you know, another sort of term that you use on your investor presentation. So In the financial summary section, there's loan originations. So year end 21, it was 4.3 million. Last year for 22 is 15.8. What exactly is that number that's increased 267%?
Oh, that is the loans that we have put on the books, loans that we have actually funded. So
the solar one that was announced, and then recently, but I think it was after the quarter end, the tier one MSO loan that you guys did.
Yep, those are the ones that we would be called originating. And so that you bring up a good point there. So how do we earn money? When you're making commercial loans across the country, first of all, you have your underwriting and origination fee. You've got to go through the work. And when we're talking about actually underwriting, you're talking about a good 45 to 60, sometimes 90 days, depending on the complexity of the loan, the number of properties, and we know the cannabis industry, the number of companies that they create to manage their business. So you're having to do a whole lot of work there. So you got the origination fee, which is also the underwriting fee. Then you have to go through, think about if you're doing 6 properties across the country, you got to go through an appraisal on every one of those properties. So it gets expensive. Yeah, but this is normal commercial. This is normal commercial expenses that you would go through with any bank or financial institution. And then you get the interest income after that on the loan. And hopefully we're in a much nicer position to give very competitive interest rates and still earn a good margin for our investors. And the last thing is servicing. You have to service a loan. And that has everything to do with, if it's a construction loan, you have to watch the construction. You have to issue the checks as the construction's built out. If it's a regular loan, you probably do an annual review. If it's a cannabis loan, you're probably doing a quarterly review. You have to keep your eyes on cannabis companies more frequently to show and demonstrate that you are fulfilling your bank secrecy obligations more than a normal commercial loan. Again, the cost of that is a premium usually to the rate that's out there normal businesses.
Yeah, I guess, I kind of suspect that that's what it was, but I almost expected that number to be higher based on what we were discussing, but maybe it'll be higher for 2023, right? So if I understand this correctly, this may be a different amount, so correct me, but in your latest financial results, you said you processed a record $1.1 billion in deposits. So I guess it's not that 1.1, there's some amount of that multiplied by 60%, and that's really your loan origination base. So what is that? Help me walk down the math from 1.1 billion in deposits.
So actually, you want to look at what we talk about, and I think this is in there. I think in that particular presentation, it talks about balances of $230 million on deposit balances. I think that's the chart you want to look to, bar charts, and it says balances on deposit. That's the money that we want to loan out. And this is also in the quarterly filings that we do in terms of what is available. So I think it's about page 33.
Yeah, I see it. $223 million, which is an increase of 57% from Q1 2022.
Yeah. So we have to, in our actual filings, we actually have to calculate what the ability of lending is against that balance. So, 60% of that is what we would loan out. Our target, though, let's talk about targets in the financial market. We are working with financial institutions. We are working off the balance sheets of financial institutions. There are, one of the biggest reasons banks fail out there is making bad loans. The second reason they fail is growing too fast. So when you think about it, now this comes from my 38 years of banking experience, you don't grow too fast and you don't grow loans too fast. So when we're working with financial institutions off their balance sheet, we have to make sure they're comfortable with what we're putting on. So our goal is only $20 million a quarter this year while we forge ahead on these relationships and get everybody comfortable. And that does take time. So I would say that we did miss first quarter in terms of lending and that goal. But the reason we did was because we changed underwriters and we changed originating officers. And we put a more conservative one in place because we needed to be more conservative with our underwriting. And we ended up not having a pipeline and rebuilding that pipeline with pure credit based upon real estate, solid non-projection loans. We had to recreate the actual ideas out there as to what Safe Harbor was all about. And we wanted to do that, especially year one, because we need to be conservative. We can't afford to take a loss on a loan, and that would be because we didn't collateralize it sufficiently. So we rebuilt the pipeline. We also brought in two new people, two of them from Avica. One is a 20-year veteran of commercial underwriting and a bank president. And the other one is Dan Rota, and he's a lawyer by trade, but then he started Avica. And when he was a lawyer in the very beginning, he worked on distressed commercial loans. So you can imagine when he's underwriting a loan at this point in time and running lending, he's looking at protecting the investors' interest in us and the financial institution and, of course, Safe Harbor and all of that.
Yeah, so I guess you guys are definitely being conservative, because if I just took the $223 million monthly average balance from Q1, 60% of that is $133 million, and your goal is only to lend, you know, 89 of that 133. So you're certainly being conservative. And I want to get a bit more details into what you're talking about on, you know, loan or bad debt or losing out on any of these loans. So has that occurred? What's kind of the loan to value? You talked about collateral. Have you had to kind of enact and take in some of those collateral for any clients in the past?
Have we had to take any back? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
No. We have not had to. You obviously, and those processes take so long that, and NASDAQ was really very careful with they went through every one of our contracts to make sure that we would never touch products. So think about a cultivation. If we had to liquidate a cultivation center, right, and it's got any kind of product in it, we have to go through a third party so as to make sure we never, never get product in Safe Harbor or of that nature. So at this point in time, lucky for us, we are not doing it, and we haven't had to do it, but we are prepared to do it should we have to, and it's in the loan documents on how we would do it. And again, if we go back to an example of a situation where, you know, somebody wanted to be a slow pay, and the fact of the matter is it was 50% loan to value on this building, and it has a personal guarantee. Now that personal guarantee makes a big difference to a financial institution. And we know when somebody gives us a personal guarantee that their net worth is usually good to cover that loan. And the second thing is when we have to liquidate a commercial property and it's 50% loan to value, then the present owner loses 50% of their equity in that property.
You haven't had to even liquidate any real estate for any past clients.
No. But we, in all fairness, you know, I say no and probably say no, but the fact of the matter is we've only been lending since 2021. Okay. But again, we're hoping that the conservative level of how we're lending is not going to get us in that situation anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm just curious. And can you tell us more about, for, you know, some of these loans that you have done, if that's a mix of cultivation and retail? I'd imagine retail is a lot easier to liquidate, 50% loan to value. Some other sort of retail, non-cannabis, can pick it up. If it's cultivation, it's probably some sort of farming operation, maybe a bit more challenging. So what's typically the collateral?
Actually, we've done both. And we've done a construction loan, you know, a build out of a facility. And that was a company, you know, probably can't go into too many details there, but we have considered that type. So we've been across the board. I would say more dispensaries than cultivations. And we really look at the traffic and we look at the, you know, value if we had to liquidate it. All this happens during underwriting. You want to know if you have to transform that building and put it on the market, how well can it transform into another type of business? So yes, if there is a cultivation that is off the beaten path that would not easily convert to another type of business, it lowers the value of that. And usually the borrower isn't really happy with the appraisal that we do at that point in time and are willing to lend on it. So I think You know, everything is risk-based again, and you've got to have, you as a banker, 38, you've got to have your eye on the potential downside there.
And I'll ask you one last question before I let you go. It's probably your favorite or your least favorite question. And I'll ask it in a different way. So, you know, there's always chatter, especially in the business you're in, about safe banking. So the question really is, do you pay attention? Do you just wait for something to pass? I'm sure people ask you for your prediction. Like, where does your mind share go on safe banking?
The first thing that goes through my mind is, you know, it's been up 7 times, shot down 7 times. And Washington is just taking its time to do something for this industry. But I think this industry has gotten so big and so important to the U.S. economy. Washington can't ignore them anymore. They have got to do something. And I think that safe banking is a good step forward. I think it's incremental, just as any legislation going through D.C. is, but it's a good step forward for the industry, but an even better step forward for those banks who are afraid of being prosecuted for actually banking the industry, or, you know, it makes them stay away from it. Nobody's been prosecuted, but I, you know, was subject to prosecution for the last 9 years. The good news of that is that all agencies wanted the money banked. They wanted the transparency. They wanted the accountability in the industry. And so it was a good thing to get into it. We just made that decision faster than most people and took that risk. And hopefully that will pay off for us in the long run.
But couldn't you have said that the 5th time, the 6th time, like that it was too big to ignore? So like we kind of said the same thing before on safe banking, right?
Yeah. It's... You know, I've done work with when Crapo was doing it in the Senate. The things that tie up legislation shouldn't tie up legislation. And so I've been out there talking, did a lot of lobbying last September out in D.C. with the senators on safe banking. And I was really surprised. It was across the board in terms of the Democrats wanted social equity programs tied to banking. And, you know, let's take banking and withhold banking until you fix social equity, you know. But to me, it didn't make a lot of sense. And the Republicans, and they were on the other side, just, you know, this is not going to go over well with my constituents. It's not going to be good for, you know, anti-money laundering laws. And at the end of the day, it's a business and it's a solid industry, and it's got to get some federal support. So I think that will win the day. And I think the election cycle coming up might help the industry.
Sounds good. I'm hopeful there as well. And I thought the last election cycle would have played out a bit more influential on our industry. But thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you.
Well, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it. Even the tough questions.